Hello, everyone. It's Joe Crump.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey.
How's it going, Joe?
Good, thank you. I know we've got quite a few people on the line, so what I'm going to do, the way I'm going to format this program is I'm going to put it into conference mode. And why don't I do that now? It takes me a couple buttons to press. Just a second. Okay, I think I'm in conference mode now, so nobody's going to be able to talk to me at the moment, but I'm going to open this call up in a little bit so that you guys can ask me questions. On the email that I sent out, I asked everybody to just email me questions that they had, and I'd cover those first. So I've got one fax, and I've got three or four or five emailed questions that I'm going to cover, and I'll just go through that as we go. I may, as I go through the emailed questions, I may open up the call after I read it and answer it, and see if that person is on the line and if they have further questions about that particular question before I move on to the second one. Just because of the way that my little structure set up going in and out of conference mode is a little cumbersome, so it'll take a second on each time I do that. All right, the first email that I've got, and by the way, this is the Cashflow members call for the people that are subscribed to my Cashflow newsletter. And this is something that I do just as a freebie for you guys, you know, every 3 or 4 months. And, you know, it's great to have it. This is the same kind of call that we do for my mentor students. My mentor students I was actually just with them for the last couple hours. We were on a call together since about noon. And they're giving me questions based on the stuff that we're working on in that program. But hopefully that you'll be able to get some stuff out of this one as well. All right, this is from Chris Martin. I've been listening to all the previous Cashflow conference calls, and they've really been a big help and helped answer some questions that I had for myself. I do have a couple, and by the way, all these are recorded and on a members site, members only site that you can go to, and you can listen to all the previous calls we've done as well. I do have a couple of questions that maybe you can answer now or during the upcoming Cashflow conference call. When you do a land contract, you make the terms of the payment over 5 years, right? What happens when you lease option it, and after a year, the tenant is able to qualify and purchase the home? Is the land contract paid off then, or is it still in effect for the next 4 years? Could you talk a little bit about finding and working with a mortgage broker to pre-qualify lease option buyers? Okay, first let's talk over the land contract question. Most of the time when you're selling a property, if it's your own property, most of the time you want to sell it on a lease option. Unless you're in Texas, then you're going to do a land contract. When you sell it on a lease option, it's safer for you, the seller, because if they stop making their payments, typically, in most states, all you have to do is evict them rather than foreclose on them. If it's a land contract, typically you have to foreclose on them before you can take the property back. Now, if you're in a town, if you're in a place like Texas, it makes sense to do land contracts because the foreclosure process is so short in Texas. It's only 60 days. You know, if you're in Indiana, you know, it's 30 days to evict somebody. It's 4 months to foreclose on someone. So, anyway, you can make the payments over any period of time that you want, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years. You can make it amortized. You can make it interest only. Typically, what I do is a 5-year interest only note with a balloon payment after 5 years or 60 months. So they'll make payments just interest only, and then they'll owe me the full amount of the loan on after 5 years. And if they want to pay it off in the meantime, they can do that. They can go get it refinanced and purchase the property or whatever during that time. But they're owners. They're not actually on the deed, but their interest is recorded. Their note, their land contract is recorded. The next question is, could you talk a little bit about finding and working with mortgage brokers to pre-qualify lease option buyers? Do you send autoresponsor messages to potential buyers to have them meet with a broker, or do you get forms from the broker, have potential buyers fill them out, and take them back to the broker? Seems like more work that way. Will buyers have to pay any kind of application fees? I'm not sure if you've got the push button method or not, but if you do, I cover all this stuff in that process because it's a pretty involved process. But basically, the first thing that you're going to do is ask them, when a buyer calls in on one of your lease option signs, the first thing you're going to do is ask them, how much money do you have for the down payment? And if they tell you, well, I've got $3,000, you say, well, if you had $5,000, I know we could make this work. Or if they tell you, I've got $5,000, you say, Well, if you had 7,000, I know we could make this work. And then you find out how much they've really got. And if they have a little extra, and see if you can bump that up, bump up the amount that they've got. And if not, then, you know, you still make the deal work with them. Just try to find out how much they've got and they're ready to go with right now. Now, if I'm going to have a mortgage broker pre-qualify them, this is one of the biggest pains that we've had trying to get mortgage brokers to actually do this, because most of these people do not qualify. 9 out of 10 people that respond to a lease option ad don't qualify, but 1 out of 10 do qualify. And so if you got a mortgage broker who's willing to do, you know, 10 quick pre-qualifications, it's going to make a life a lot easier. I'm going to suggest that you talk to them, or you have somebody that you've trained talk to them, to the buyers first, and find out if they've got good credit. If they don't have, you know, or find out if they know their FICO score. Or a lot of people think, well, I got bad credit because I had a bankruptcy 2 years ago. But have you reestablished? Yeah, I bought a car since then. You know, I've got a new credit card. Well, then they know that their bankruptcy is going to be on there for 10 years, so they think that keeps them from getting a mortgage when it doesn't. After 2 years, they can usually get a conventional mortgage. So you might be able to get those people qualified. Then you could get them connected with a mortgage broker, or I'm sorry, with a real estate agent. Real estate agent can find them a property, and they could give you a cut in the deal. Not as a commission cut if you're not licensed, but they can give you a marketing fee or some other way to pay you. So it's good to know what these people can do. And if they don't qualify, I think this whole question is based on the fact that they don't qualify now. When will they qualify? You want to know when are they going to be able to qualify for this for the loan? If they're doing a 1 year lease option, do they need a 3 year lease option? Is it something they can get their credit in order in 1 year, or, you know, is it not fair to them to take a $5,000 non-refundable lease option fee on something that you know that they're not going to be able to perform on? I don't think that's a good thing to do. You want to give them a 2 or 3 year lease option if they're in that situation. Because almost anybody can get their credit cleaned up in 2 or 3 years. The only thing that keeps you from doing that is lawsuits or problems with the IRS, where they've got huge liens and you can't get rid of them through bankruptcy. I think that's all the questions that Chris has here. Let me go to the emails that I've got. And I'm not going to open the call for Chris because it didn't sound like he said he wasn't going to probably be able to make the call. The next one is from Jay Lewis. Looks like I've got two little emails here from him. Says, what costs are associated with closing? From the training materials of the Stupid Proof system, I see that I need a purchase contract and a disclosure form, and at the time of close, a warranty deed and an assignment form and a second mortgage. Are all these that I need to pay for with the title company? Well, no, you don't need to pay the title company for all this stuff. And it depends on the type of closing that you're doing. If you're doing a subject to, that's going to be different than a multi-mortgage. If you're doing a land contract, that's different from the previous two. If you're doing a lease option, you know, so there's different hierarchies of structures. And my hierarchy of structure is subject to multi-mortgage, land contract, and lease option. If you have any of my materials, or if you've been reading my newsletter, which I expect you have or you wouldn't be on this call, you probably have an idea of what these different structures are. You know, for you as a seller or as the buyer, you always want to buy with a subject to. But when you sell, you want to sell on a lease option, because lease option's at the bottom of the hierarchy. It's the easiest to get rid of the buyer, and it's the hardest to get rid of the. And subject to is the hardest to get rid of the buyer. So if you're buying, you want to buy with the way that's hardest to get rid of you, and if you're selling, you want to sell with the way that's easiest to get rid of the buyer, and protect yourself the best way. So you want to know your hierarchy of structures. Now, as far as the course in the Stupid Proof course, all those documents are there. The purchase contract is there. The disclosure is there. You're going to need to get a warranty deed. So the only thing that you really need, if you're doing a subject to have your attorney draw up for you, is a warranty deed. And you're only going to need to have that done for you once. And once they do that, ask them to email it to you, because they'll send it to you in a document file. That way you can modify it for future deals that you do, and you can use the one that's going to be approved for your area and your town and your county recorder. So have that done. Now, if you're doing a multi-mortgage, that means you are going to need a second mortgage drawn up, because you're taking the first subject to the existing loan, and you're taking a second mortgage for their equity. Let's say they owe... you're buying the property for $150,000. They owe $120,000 on the current mortgage. They deed you the property. You take over the current mortgage subject to the existing loan, so you owe $120,000 on that. but they want their equity out of the property, so they're going to have a second mortgage for $30,000. You're going to owe a total of $150,000 on the property. There's going to be a first for $120,000, and there's going to be a second, and that second needs to be made out by an attorney at least until you understand how to do it. And once again, you can have them email it to you, and then you can create them for the future. But I would suggest have an attorney put together the second mortgage and note for you so that it's done properly and so that you can record it properly. Should I get title insurance or just a title search? On subject two, I don't think you need title insurance. I just do a title search. It's called a preliminary title report. If you pay for them, you're going to get it for $150. Yeah, if you have a relationship with the title company, if you're an agent, or if you know somebody at a title company, or if you can convince them that you're going to be working with them in the future, a lot of times they'll do it for free. They do those things all the time on these types of deals, and they don't charge for them. But if you do, you know, if you don't know them, they may want to charge it. And that'll also tell you what the problems are in the title. The only thing that a title company does before they give title insurance is they pull up a preliminary title report at the county recorders to find if there's any liens or encumbrances on the property. If there are, then they don't give it title insurance. If there aren't, then they give it title insurance. So if you get a preliminary title report and there aren't any liens on there, you know that there's no liens on there, or at least you've got a pretty good chance there aren't. I suppose something could creep up there on the time after from the time you buy. Also, which of these docs should I run down to the county clerk to file? Well, you have to record your note and warranty deed. You got your mortgage and your note. You don't record your disclosure. You don't record your purchase agreement. But just the stuff that they need at the county recorder. What's a good average cost to close? Eventually, it's not going to cost you anything except the cost to record the deed, which, you know, they may cost you $7-$10 a page to record it at the county recorder. To actually have a warranty deed drawn up, I mean, you're talking $50-$75 to do that. A note and mortgage, you're looking at $150 to put something like that together. Every title company is going to be a little different on their pricing. Just ask them how much they charge for that kind of stuff. If you close at a title company, which most title companies, when you do subject two, they don't want you to close in there because you're not getting title insurance through them. And they feel, a lot of title companies feel, that if you're not getting title insurance through them, they don't want to close it because they feel that it could be perceived that they're giving you title insurance because you're closing at a title company. And they don't ever want that to come back against them. So they can draw all the documents up for you, or their attorney can, and then you can go close them with a notary, find a notary and close them at your bank or whatever. Or you just close them over the kitchen table. The signatures on the deed have to be notarized. And then you want to record the thing after it's done. Take it down to the county recorder. You can often get all the documents together and bring it back to the title company, and they'll record it for you for a small fee. I see other investor signs which state that they can close in 3 days. I suppose this is a good idea only if the house is already empty. Well, the only way that they're closing in 3 days is if they get title insurance. Just because they put it on a sign doesn't mean they can do it. All those cash for your home signs don't mean cash for your homes necessarily, unless you want to sell it for, you know, $10 and it's worth $100,000 or something like that. Then they're happy to give you cash. And some of those investors can do cash, but they can come up with a check. They can write it right out of their equity, home equity line or whatever, out of their bank accounts. I know investors that can do that. I can do that kind of thing. But they still need to get title insurance before they close, and title insurance typically takes 3 or 4 days just to get it. So if that's the case, they can do it. Obviously, you want to have all your pieces in all your ducks in a row before you close the deals, especially if you're paying cash for the property. You say several times that when you take a home subject to, you never have to deal with the seller again. Do you need to have the seller sign a power of attorney so you can talk with the mortgage company or insurance company? Since there's still the seller's name, or does the warranty deed give you that power? Well, you're going to have a letter signed by the seller saying that to send the new payments to your address. You're going to deed the property over to you, so you're going to be on the property. You're going to have the insurance change to a new company, you're going to have the seller on there as additionally insured so that he's covered as well. But you're going to be covered, and it's going to be a landlord policy, so it's going to end up being actually cheaper. Now, there are some people that are concerned about the due on sale clause when they do a subject two, and I'm not concerned about due on sale clauses. I've seen hundreds of these deals go down. I've never seen one due on sale clause actually exercised. I saw it threatened twice, and they backed off as soon as we told them they could have the property, because there's no equity in these properties. And a bank's not going to foreclose on a property that has no equity in it, or very little equity. If it doesn't have 50% or 60% equity in it, it's not worth it to them to put a damaging mark on their credit report. Every time they have to foreclose, that asset, that house, becomes a non-performing asset, which puts a ding on their credit report as a bank, which makes, if their credit gets too bad, then it makes it impossible for them to sell their loans on the secondary market, which puts them out of business. So they don't want to do that unless they have to, or unless they have some overriding reason to do that. If you've taken over a property and you're making the payments on it, there's really no reason for them to foreclose. The only time I saw it where I thought it might really happen was where the property, and this wasn't mine, this was somebody else, where they had a property that had a ton of equity in it, and it wasn't a countrywide bank, it wasn't a national bank, it was a small hometown bank, and the guy knew the owner, he knew everybody involved, and he saw dollar signs. He knew that if he could foreclose, he could get this house at an extreme discount. So he started the foreclosure process. But it made sense at that point because the investor that had so much equity in the property, it was very easy for him to go out and refinance the property, even though his credit wasn't that great. And he could have sold it on the MLS. There's lots of things he could have done. When you have that much equity in the property, you got a lot of safety in there. And if they're going to do a due on sale, they still have to foreclose on the property. So typically you've got 4 to 6 months in most states to be able to find something to do with that property, so you don't lose your equity. If you don't have any equity in the property, you don't really have too much risk here. I mean, they can take the property back if they want. And that's what we told them when they threatened us twice. But like I said, we've done this hundreds of times, and that's the only times it's happened to us. So it's unlikely. And at the beginning, I used to do it where we would, make it more difficult for them to figure out that we've transferred the property, we've put them into trusts and all that stuff, which, I mean, these are all these tricks. I just want to be upfront about stuff and show them, look, this, we're taking over this property, we're going to rent it out, we're going to manage it, we're going to eventually sell it and make a profit on it. And when we do that, we don't have a problem with it. Let's see, there's a lot of questions here. I'm going to cover one more. What if you want to take it subject to but need to negotiate a payment plan to get it back on track? Then you'd have to be able to talk to the lender, the loss mitigation department. I would suggest that you try to get your seller to do that for you before you take it over. But if not, then you're going to need to get permission from the seller in writing to talk to the loss mitigation department, and you can fax it over and they'll allow you to talk to them. It's the same thing you would do as if it were a short sale. It's a pain in the butt, and it's no fun to talk to the lender, but you can get a lot of things solved, and you can get these things put on the back of the loan. You can get them to reduce the payments. You can get them to cancel them altogether. It depends on the lender, and it depends on how big their foreclosure portfolio is right now and how much they want that property back. Okay, next question here. This is from John Ayers. I'm working in the Sacramento, California area. Many of the people I talk to are upside down in their loans. They owe more than their property is now worth, and they have ARMs that are about to reset to much higher rates. I don't want to take a bad loan on a subject to deal. How can I help these folks and make a deal that works for everyone? Well, there are only two types of deals that make sense for you. One is you buy properties for cash substantially under market value, and two, that you buy properties on terms at market value or below. But if they're over market value or much over market value, it's going to be very difficult to make a profit on them. So this happened in California back in the 90s, early 90s, where 91, I think, is when I got caught in this whole crash where the values dropped 30%. So would it have made sense to take property subject to, 30% under market value? It would have if I could have rented them out, because most of those back then were good. Were decent mortgages. They weren't low. They were 8-9%, but they still made they were in a position where we could have rented them out. We could have lease optioned them. We could have done all right with properties like that. But when the values drop that substantially, if you've got that much, if you've over financed the property, the values dropped, whatever, If they're upside down, it's going to be hard to make the deal work. But there is a way to make it work. And we've done this in Vegas. We've done it in Los Angeles. I did it in Los Angeles quite a bit, actually. What you do is you get the seller to rent the property out, rent to buy. And you find a lease option tenant for the property. The seller is going to take a negative on their property. But they know that if they sell the property, they're going to have to come up with a ton of cash. You know, they may have to come up with $50,000 to sell it. So for them to take a $1,000 a month negative cash flow is not the worst thing in the world that could happen to them. The other option they may have is to go into foreclosure. And, you know, that may be an option they have to take if they're too upside down on the property. All right, next question is from John Anderson. I'm a student of yours and purchaser of the push-button method. I'm a full-time employed and learning my real estate as per your newsletters and CDs. However, I've been sidetracked recently by a foreclosure short sale possibility where my partner and I stand to make a good pop. The property was originally for sale for $224,900 with a broker who still has the property listed. The occupant stopped making the mortgage payments about 3 months ago, and the broker is working with us and the bank so we can do a short sale and take over the property. I've inspected the property. We consider a fixer-upper to get it as a saleable state. I don't particularly care about, I just prefer to get something to walk away from. I already written a report to the bank and made their offer of $85,000 as is, estimated repair cost of $55,000. We have a buyer that has been approved for $170,000. He can give me to tie up $1,000. We're proposing to do a double closing. Question is, what would you do to conclude in this situation? I'm reluctant to stick out my neck as far. Look, if you get that property for $85,000, that is a great deal. The likelihood that you're going to get a short sale for that much under property, I mean, I don't think I understand here how much is owed on the property. So I don't know how much they would have to reduce their profit to make that happen. If it's close to the $224,900, the likelihood they're going to $85,000 is almost inconceivable. I don't see that happening. The way that a short sale is done, and I don't suggest doing short sales. I think they're really complicated. You got to deal with lenders who are a pain in the butt, and I don't think they're as profitable as some of the other things that we're doing for the amount of work that has to be done. Now, that's not to say you can't make money in short sales. A lot of people have. I have. I know, you know, other people that have, and there's some good programs out there that teach this stuff, but I think short sales are more work than they're worth, and they're a lot of pain, and you're really relying on the lenders to come through, and they can take months and months. It sounds to me like you said yourself here, you got sidetracked on your real business to take care of this one deal that probably is not going to happen because you can't, they're not going to discount it that much. Put yourself in the position of a bank and determine how much you want for that property. And you're going to do it by, first of all, having a broker's opinion done on the property, a valuation done of the property in as-is condition. So if he goes in there and says, well, this property is worth $200,000 or $170,000, let's say it's worth $170,000 right now, if you're able to sell it for $170,000, or maybe it's worth more or less than that because you got to do the repairs or whatever, maybe it is only worth $125,000, $130,000. If it's only worth $125,000, then $85,000 may be possible because they're going to back out of that. But if it's worth, you know, closer to $200,000, it's going to be unlikely that they're going to do it if it's that price and as is condition. They're going to look at that. They're going to say, okay, if the broker tells me it's worth this much, and by the way, if you're doing a short sale, you want to meet the broker at the house when he does the thing with all your comps, showing him why it's not worth what he thinks it is, and show him all the terrible things about the house that are wrong with it to try to bring the value down. But so he's you're bringing the value down of the property and you're trying to get him to come as low as you can. But they're going to go back to the lender and say, okay, it's worth this much. If you sell it with a realtor, the realtor costs you this much. You know, the average price of this is going to come in at this. You're going to put on the MLS. It's going to take this many months to sell it. You know, here's what you can expect as best case scenario. Here's what you can expect as worst case scenario as far as getting this property. And it's probably going to be within 25% of its real market value. It's not going to be 50% off its real market value. So that I think that's what it all comes down to. Now, if you're buying this property and you do get it for this value and you have to put $55,000 into it, are you going to do the work yourself or are you going to, you know, sell it as an assignment to somebody else who's going to come in and take the work? Now, if you're doing a short sale, you got to buy the property first, then resell it. So you got to pay for the loan which is going to cost you about 5% on non-owner occupied loans. Cost you about 5% to buy the loan if you get, you know, if you got good credit. So if you're going to put the money into it, then you've got this extra 55 grand you got to come up with, which you can, you might be able to borrow hard money, or you might be able to borrow from an investor, or you might be able to come out of pocket to do it, but then you've got a lot of risk because you're putting this money on the line. Then you got to fix the property up. $55,000 improvement is not a small job. That's a big job. And you're either going to hire somebody to do it for you, which you're going to have to really pay attention to, because they will take your money very quickly. And this happened to many, many of my students. I don't recommend getting into rehabs very often. I think that it's a lot of work for the effort. I'd much rather see you assign it to somebody else or sell it to somebody else. You could even put it on the MLS in as-is condition and sell it that way and just make a few thousand dollars. I prefer to see you go find properties that are better deals and just take assignment fees. Even if you just took $5,000, $10,000 on deals like this, you'd be doing okay. But because you're doing it through a short sale through a bank, you have to close the deal. You can't assign those deals. It's very rare that a bank will allow you to assign a deal that you're buying from them. They want to know that you're the principal, that you're buying it, before they'll cut the deal with you, before they'll even start negotiating with you. So hopefully that helps you. Okay, next question is from Martin. A while back, I got your push-button method, and I got very excited because it makes a lot of sense to me. I wanted to start with the for-rent method, the lease option, and got very discouraged when they told me that we couldn't do lease options in Texas anymore. Is this true? If so, is there any other way around it? And what should I do? Yes, it is true. Yeah. let me clarify that. You are allowed to do lease options in Texas. That's still legal, and there are ways that you can do it. We're doing a lot of deals down in Texas right now. So I really wanted to do lease options, and when this law came about, I was looking at all the different ways we could make it work, make their laws work, because the regulations and the requirements that they have for reporting to the buyer are so onerous that they become very expensive to do, and it just doesn't make sense to do anymore. So we looked at the whole situation. So what can we do in place of that? Because, you know, we're based on this for rent method, and then of course I'm buying all these, building all these properties down there, and we're doing the pre-construction stuff and all that stuff for my investors. And what I came up with was, if we wanted to sell the properties, we'd sell them. If we want to do the for rent method, we would do it with land contracts rather than lease options. And as I said earlier on this call, land contracts you have to foreclose on rather than a lease option, which typically you only have to evict, which it takes less time. But in Texas, they have, even though they have the most difficult lease option law, they have the least difficult foreclosure law. It only takes 60 days to foreclose in Texas. So it's very, very friendly of mortgages, very unfriendly of investors. But so you can do this. You can do this exact same method. Just replace lease option, wherever we talk about it, replace lease option with land contract. And instead of doing the lease option memo, you'll have to use a land contract purchase agreement. And all those things are in that push button method in that data file, so you'll be able to find those there and just use it that way. It'll work exactly the same. And I've got mentor students that are doing it. I was on the call with my mentor students just a little while ago, and same situation arose, and we were talking about how to make that stuff work. And he's modified his website, everything, so that it says lease or says land contract instead of lease option. Now, if you're in a place that allows lease option, do it on lease option. But if you're not, then you still can sell it on terms like this. And there's lots of ways to find lots of good buyers when you do it this way. Excuse me. All right, the last question that I've got on an email here is from, and as soon as I'm done here, I'm going to open up the call so you guys can ask me questions. And by the way, if you're not going to ask a question right now, if you wouldn't mind pressing *6, and it'll put you into mute. If you do that anyway, if you want to ask a question, you hit *6, and it'll bring you back into full voice when I bring it out of conference mode. Been talking for 3 hours straight here, so okay. Next question is from Mark Idzik. I'm moving more to the subject to method of buying homes to offer to my buyers, and less working with investor homes to do the rent to own method. I found that none make sense to buy in this market. I guess rent to buy. For example, most every homeowner I contact that wants an offer on their home has little or no equity, which is okay, and a mortgage payment that is often almost double what the market rent is for that type of home in the area. And that's really not a problem, because those people, if they've got their home advertised for rent, they're usually renting it for less than what their payment is, and there's no reason for them not to do a lease option for that same amount. So just approach it a little bit differently. He continues to say, I can see opportunity in this market to help. How could one make these types of transactions work today? I've asked some homeowners to help with the mortgage payments. Any suggestions? Yeah, that's exactly what I just suggested. Since we spoke on your call-in, things are going well. Up to over 2,800 buyers now and growing. Congratulations. That's a great buyers list. Now you got to learn how to monetize that thing. Now, let me give you some tips on monetizing this, because I'll bet you're not doing them. Hopefully, you've got if I remember our conversation, you've got an autoresponder set up and in place, got the website set up, you're using the push-button stuff, so all that stuff is there for you to use if you've got that program. And an autoresponder is a series of emails that goes out to your buyers and tells them what they need to do, or how to get started, how to get going, and keeps touch with them without you having to call every one of them, every month. You got 2,800 people, you're not going to be able to talk to them all the time, but you can create a constant stream of business from these people, and you can get them to go out and find their own properties. This has just been a wonderful thing for us, for people that have good lists. So what you want to do is you want to add a couple of emails or add a couple of things to these autoresponders that I've got in the push button method. This is something we came up since I wrote that. One thing is, you want to tell them to go to FSBO.com or ForSaleByOwner.com or whatever your local ForSaleByOwner.com site is, and tell them, if you find 3 or 4 or 5 properties on there, it's very likely that I'll be able to put together a deal for you on lease option out of those. I can't do it with everyone, but I can do it with some of them. So find your own property. Go on this website, find a property you want. I'll contact the buyers, and I'll put together the deal as a rent-to-buy. And you use the all the methods that I teach on the for rent method to put that together, and it works very well. And it gets people to call you, and it gets them to do the work for you to find the buyers. That way, you've got a buyer in place. And I'll tell you, it's a lot easier to get a seller to sell to you if you've already got somebody who wants to buy the property. Look, I've got somebody, he wants to pay this amount a month, every month for it. He'll pay you this month on the lease option. He'll exercise the option in a year or 2 years. Would you be interested? If I'm a seller, I'm a for sale by owner, and I'm either greedy or I'm, and I don't want to pay an agent, which that's what half the for sale by owners want, or I don't have enough money to pay an agent and I'm poor, both of those things sound good to me, because I get the most money, I don't have to pay an agent, I get good monthly income. It's a great way for them to sell the properties. Not all of them are going to do it. Some of them want their cash out now. But the ones that are either smart or needy are going to do it this way. So good luck with it. That's congratulations on that list. There's so many things you can do on that to continue to build that list and to monetize it. Start thinking about other ways that you can do it. The other thing that you could do with these buyers is you could teach them, you could say, look, I'll connect you with my mortgage broker or with my real estate agent. That real estate agent will help you go into the MLS and help you find a property. You will have to pay 5% over the asking price of whatever property you buy, because I'm going to have an investor buy that property for you. So you have to build an investor list to do this, by the way. Or at least you have to have some investors that want to buy properties, have equity, and a lease option tenant in place. It is very easy. I mean, it's a no-brainer for an investor. If he's got a tenant in place, a lease option buyer, he's going to buy it for 5% over. You go in and you can negotiate the price on the purchase of the property for hopefully 5% under, so you've got some equity in that property. You're going to get money on the lease option fee from the buyer. You're going to get money from the real estate agent, because you're going to get a cut on his commission or marketing fee or whatever is legal, and you're going to get maybe a grand or something from the investor to take over the property, as long as there's enough of a spread in there to make it make sense for him. It's really a great win-win deal for everybody involved. And instead of making, $2,000 or $5,000, you make $10,000 or $15,000 on the deal. You can also take a note on the deal if you want to. You can, keep your fingers into the pie after it's done. Or you can buy the property yourself if you're in a position to do that. This is a great way to buy your own rental properties. If you have good credit and you want to buy these properties, it's a great way to do it. All right. Well, I'm going to open the call up here and just a second. Okay, the call is open. That means we can hear everything that happens in your background. So if there's any noise or anything where you're at, press star 6 and it will mute you out. You can always come back and ask questions by pressing star 6. It will bring you back into the call. All right, I'm going to open the call up for questions. Who's got a question for me?
Hey, Joe, this is John down in Knoxville. I missed the other call earlier today.
Hey, John.
How you doing?
Good. How about yourself?
I'm doing wonderful. I was going to ask you, I think I'm getting ready to close a deal on the for rent message, and, of course, it's going to be the buyer, the seller, and me. Would I need to have 3 copies of all of the documents to give to everybody, or would I just... I don't know exactly what copies I know what copies to give, but I don't know how many.
Get everything signed and then make copies for everybody. Everybody should get a copy of the complete documents, of the completely signed documents. So yes, you need 3 sets.
Okay. That's all I wanted to know.
Okay. Good luck with it.
Yes, sir.
How's it going otherwise? You getting some deals done?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to do whenever you're working full-time, you know how that is, 40 hours a week.
Sure.
So it's just, you know, going a little slow, but I hadn't given up on it. It's just taking some time, just like you said, just like with anything else.
Good. Well, life gets in the way, I know that, but if you keep at it, it'll start getting easier for you, and you'll start, eventually you start realizing that, hey, I'm making more money doing this in a lot less time.
Yeah, I can't wait till that day.
All right, good luck.
Yes, sir.
Who else has questions?
Joe?
Yes. Who's this?
This is Jim in Massachusetts.
Hey, Jim.
Thank you for all the help that you've given us. We're about to kick off our business on the 31st of July.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you for responding to the email. I have a question. Can we have a comment, a clause, to have people quit and leave a property instead of evicting them?
So if they just have them move out, you mean?
Yeah, I have something in the contract that says they have to move out if they don't perform.
Well, it does say that. I mean, it says basically that they've defaulted and they've got to get out. And it doesn't say that, you know, the eviction process is only for people that won't move out. You only need to evict people if they don't move out. Now, you need to start, if they don't pay you after the first 5, 6, 7 days, you need to start the eviction process. But hopefully they'll move out before the eviction actually happens. You know, the majority of tenants will move out long before the sheriff comes along. They don't want to be put out by the cops. So you don't really need that in there. Now, what you might want to do if you have a lease option, when they move out, you might have them sign a release on the contract. Say, look, you know, you've defaulted and you know, this contract is now null and void. You know, please sign this. And they may do that or they may not. I'd say the majority of people that have defaulted on me and moved out, I've not gotten a release on. And most of them move out before I have to go through the entire eviction process. But sometimes you got to go through the entire eviction process. That's why you start it early on. You don't wait, you know, to get it. Mine is 7 days. That's what I tell all my property managers. I want them to start the foreclosure process within 7 days if they haven't made their payments. And that's not to be a hard guy. It's just because I got a mortgage on there. I got to pay. And I need them out if they're not going to pay. Is that kind of a sideways way to answer that question? Did I solve that?
Oh, that was good. Thank you very much.
Okay.
The other thing is, should we be doing, we shouldn't be doing anything then with zero down on a lease option.
Well, if you're, are you the seller or are you working on the for rent method, where you're flipping it? Are you doing?
Hello.
You're the seller, so you're lease optioning a property. Are you on a note? You have a mortgage on the property.
Right.
And are you having a hard time getting a lease option fee?
Oh no,
okay.
Not at all.
Then there's no reason to do zero down. You know,
don't do them.
If I had a mortgage on a property, I'm not able to get a tenant in there, and somebody comes along, but they've only got the first month's rent, but they don't have a lease option fee, and I want to get that thing rented, I'll rent it sometimes. Maybe I'll work it out so that they pay me the lease option fee, maybe $300 a month for, you know, 4 months or something. or whatever the, you know, break it up so that I can still get a lease option fee. And a lot of times that'll work. You don't always get it, but sometimes you do. My main concern, if I've got a mortgage on a property, is to get that mortgage covered. And I want it covered by somebody who's competent or who's going to be reliable enough to make their payments. So that's what I'm more concerned about that than getting a lease option fee if I've got a mortgage on there. Now, if I'm doing a subject to deal and the only place I'm making money is through the lease option fee, I wouldn't do a zero down ever because it wouldn't make sense. I wouldn't make any money on the deal at all. Do you see the distinction?
Yes.
Okay. You understand? Do you understand?
I've got a mortgage company for our new business that got me a couple of mortgages in the past with a couple of past partners I had bought and flipped two pieces. And I've gone down and seen them again, known each other quite well. And they're willing to do all the screening for people before we put them into a lease option to see that they're going to be ready to buy in a few years.
Okay.
That's up to you.
That's great. The trick is, will they really do it? Just because they agree to do it doesn't mean they'll actually do it. So you got to kind of stay on top of them to see if they do it. Because what they're going to find out is that about 1 in 10 of those people they talk to, that call on those ads, they will qualify. So they could get them a mortgage right now. And my feeling is you get those people to a real estate agent. And hopefully the agent will give you a cut of whatever they make on the deal. So the real estate agent makes money right away on those, and the others he'll make money on later. The problem is with mortgage brokers is they, you know, if you hand them 100 leads, it's a lot of work to call 100 leads and qualify them. So you might want to hire somebody to actually do that job for you, because to find a mortgage broker to actually do that, even though they say they're going to do it, in my experience, has been very difficult.
To hire somebody to do what now?
What part didn't you understand?
I lost it. Instead of having the mortgage company qualify these people or say they're going to be able to be qualified in a couple of years.
Get somebody else to do the
qualification. Can I hire to do that?
You could hire somebody to do the qualification for you. You could hire somebody just to make these calls for you to your sellers and use the pre-qualification sheet that I gave you. Do you have the push-button method?
Not yet. That's our next purchase.
Okay. In there, there's a buyer qualification sheet. And you can go through and ask them those questions, and you can do the qualification yourself or have somebody do them. That's more likely to help you build that relationship. When you make that initial call, whether it's you or whether it's somebody that works for you, have them do that. If you're the only one running your business, then it's going to be you that makes that call. But when you start putting signs out, one of my mentor students on my last call, he put out some signs. I don't know, put out 15, 20 signs. He got 50 calls over the weekend. For buyers. So when you get that many calls, it's hard to call them all back. And, you know, we've had situations where we would have, you know, 400 or 500 calls a week on the kind of signs that we put out. So it's really hard to keep up with all those. And a mortgage broker, he's just going to implode. He's, you know, at first he's going to be very excited about the concept, but when he starts doing it, he's not going to be as excited because it's going to feel like he's doing a whole lot of work for not very many leads.
Right, I understand that, and we are going to use the yellow chloroplast signs and the ugly signs as you instruct. But we're going to have—I have two Vantage phone lines, so we're going to instruct or educate the buyers what they're supposed to do. And what I think I was talking about was to simply take the—and again, maybe I'm confused here—take the people that we say lease option for 2 years to see if those people are going to qualify. Somewhere down the line.
Correct. The most important thing for you is how much money they got for a down payment. I mean, if you're selling your properties on a lease option, if you're selling your properties, your personal properties on a lease option, you have to decide, do I want to sell these properties or do I want to keep them long term? Do I want them to cash out after a year or 2 years or 3 years, or do I want to keep them long term? If you want them to cash out, then you want to find lease option buyers with larger lease option fees, larger lease option payments. Because if they put yourself in the position of a buyer. Let's say you find that $150,000 property, you were able to get in with $2,000 lease option fee and, you know, $1,200 a month. And then you've got another lease option buyer, he paid $5,000 lease option fee plus $1,200 a month. Everything else being equal, the one that's most likely to exercise his option is the one who put $5,000 down, because it's non-refundable money. He'll lose his $5,000 if he doesn't exercise the option. So it's more likely that a person with more money up front is going to be in a position to be able to buy that property when his option before his option expires. So if your goal is to sell, make sure those lease option people exercise, you want to find people that have more money for a lease option fee. If your goal is to keep them long term, then you want to find people that have less option fee, because it's less likely that they'll exercise. Overall, 30% of lease option buyers will exercise their option, but more of them will, more of the people who put more money down will exercise than people who put less money down. So all you can go through, you can spend a whole lot of time qualifying these people and going through every detail about their credit report, but you got to decide how much time you want to put into that stuff. You know, let them do it themselves. Have them go call a mortgage person. Tell them, look, you just make yourself comfortable that you're going to be able to qualify for this thing in 2 years or 3 years when it's time to buy it. Just make sure you're comfortable with it, because I don't want you to buy the property. You know, you're not going to be able to do it unless you want to make sure, absolutely sure, that they can qualify. Which still, it's only a 30% chance that they're going to exercise. So don't go into these deals thinking that every one of them is going to exercise their option. Does that help explain
right. it? Thank you. That keys to memory all of our reading, too.
Yeah.
We're looking to, you know, at least have somebody, you know, come up with the $5,000 or more
right.
short-term to sell, is what I got out of
your
material.
When you advertise, don't advertise $5,000 down. You know, if you're advertising for lease options, put rent to buy, no qualifying, phone number, and website if you've got it. And when you get your calls, the first question you ask the people, how much have you got for a down payment? And then you find out how much they've got. And, you know, if you've got a property that you want to get lease optioned, and you've got a buyer that has $2,000 for a lease option fee, does it make sense to take that $2,000? I mean, only you can make that decision. Sometimes it makes sense to take the $2,000 rather than waiting another 2 months for $5,000. You know, you have to decide, does it make sense to do the more quantity, or does it make sense to get the very best people that you want in there? It's similar to what I'm experiencing with some of the people that are buying the pre-construction properties that we're buying. You know, I've got property managers out there, and they find them a tenant, but that tenant's a smoker, and they don't want a smoker in their house. They'd rather make that monthly payment. And if they have enough money to do that, then it's not a problem. But if they don't have enough money to do that, then they need to take that smoker. You know, they have to make that decision themselves, which makes the most sense. Or they've got a tenant that has a dog. You know, you have to decide, what kind of tenant am I going to be willing to accept? I find that the people that have the most experience, the landlords or people that own property that have the most experience, are going to qualify less on the people. Because they know that if they've got any experience in this business, they know that just because somebody looks good on paper, they got good credit, everything looks great, they got a job, doesn't mean that they're not going to lose that job tomorrow, doesn't mean that they're not going to screw up their credit tomorrow, doesn't mean they're not going to get a divorce tomorrow, whatever, to screw things up for them. So it's not really about the credit. It's about, you know, how solid does this person look to you? It's a gut thing. You know, sometimes it's just a matter, they've got enough money now to do it, let's get them going. The worst thing could happen here is they default, I have to get them out, I go find somebody else with another lease option fee. So if I made, you know, $3,000-$4,000 on the first lease option fee, I've got 3 or 4 months, you know, vacancy covered, you know, if they default. So it's not such a bad thing. So you want to try to get as much as you can, but you also have to make decisions sometimes to take less money if it still makes sense, just to get the deal done so you can move on to the next deal.
Thank you.
Okay.
So could you repeat, please? You said to have your app rent ad say rent to...
Rent to buy, or this is a bandit sign. Rent to buy, no qualifying, bad credit okay, and a phone number. Now, I've got lots of variations on that, and if you got my push-button method, there's a whole CD on signs and how to place them and where to put them and all that stuff, because that'll increase your cost, you know, increase your lead generation. You know, the signs, those bandit signs, are one of the cheapest cost per lead methods of finding buyers that I've ever seen. It's just really inexpensive. You can run ads in the paper, and those work fine, but your cost per lead is going to be 3 or 4 times as high. Alrighty.
They can put up, as well as the signs looking for sellers, some signs this way looking for buyers.
Correct. Yeah, put up
Very good.
Put up both. You know, you're going to get the most calls on your buyer signs. Your seller signs, you'll only get a few calls on. Your buyer signs, you'll get more calls on if you place them properly. And handwrite them. At the beginning, handwrite them. It's cheaper. You can do it on cardboard. You can do it on Coroplast. You know, you can go to the grocery store down the street and take their boxes out of their dumpster and cut up. I mean, the uglier these things are, the better. And you just get a magic marker and write this stuff on there. As long as it's legible and you got a phone number they can get to, you know, they can paste it to or staple it to a grape stake and stick it in the ground. Or you can buy the bandit signs from, you know, all these companies that sell this kind of stuff. But you're going to pay $6 or $7 a sign for those when you can, you know, you can get a piece of Coroplast and a grape stake for $2 and get them into the ground for that. You can also hire people to put those signs out for you. You got to constantly look for new people because it's not a very fun job. But typically, you should be able to pay from $1 to $2.50 for each sign placed. So if you want to have 100 signs placed around the city, you can get those done for a few $100, and you'll get a lot of leads from it. So, but test first. Find out what kind of feedback you get from the city, because they don't like you putting out signs. So find out what kind of feedback you get from the city, and you know how much threat they give you, and then decide whether it's worth it to you or not. We found that it's been worth it most of the time. Okay, let's give somebody else.
Thank you. We've already got our Coroplast printer. We've called 5 printers. Hopefully, he's going to give us, I think, some bulk that I'm going to cut out myself and use a magic marker. And I've got one of those slapstick hammers for putting on insulation in a new house. We're going to use that. Put them up.
That's great. You in Maine?
Later.
Are you in Maine?
We're in Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, okay. Kind of catching that Eastern accent there. All right, well, good
luck. Yeah, we have a few foreclosures here.
Yeah, well, good luck to you. That's sounds like you've gotten a good start. I'm anxious to hear
how it goes.
Thank you,
Joe, and you have definitely turned my head around, and we're looking forward to, we're pushing for the September class.
Oh, great. Well, just let me know if you want to do it. It's going to be a fun one.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks now. Bye-bye. Who else has a question for me?
Joe, you talked about the lease option in Texas, and are you aware of the new law that's going to take place in January of 2008 that's going to make it more difficult to do Subject 2? And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts as to how to work with this.
I haven't seen the legislation yet. And by the way, anybody who's, you know, if you flush a toilet on this call and you don't have Star 6 pressed, we all get a hearing. I haven't seen the legislation on that. Why don't you email it to me? I'd love to see it.
Okay.
But I'll give you my comments on it if you email it to me.
All right.
But I think that there's still other ways that you can do it. You can still do land contracts. You know, there's always going to be ways that you can do this. You just got to work around the new legislations as they happen. Texas is getting crazy with some of this stuff, and eventually it's going to bounce back because they can't keep this stuff forever. I mean, there's legitimate companies that want to do lease options, and they're making it so difficult that it's become ridiculous. So Texas is, you know, a highly legislated area, and it's getting kind of silly. But there are other ways to do this stuff. You just have to look for them, and I'll be happy to give you my thoughts if you want to send me the legislation. I have not seen it.
Okay.
Who else?
Joe?
Yes.
Joe?
Yes.
Joe, you were saying before to have the buyers looking for sale by owner. Do you tell them to ask the people that they're the sellers whether or not they're going to consider a lease option?
Absolutely.
Or just find a place.
Well, do you have the push button method?
I don't have the push button. I have the stupid proof system.
Okay. Well, the for rent method is in stupid proof too as well. It was a bonus, so yeah, that's it's in there as well. The main thrust of the for rent method is landlords and the for rent ads, but FSBOs is working pretty well as well. But we use a little different script for FSBOs, and I can't remember it right off the top of my head, but it's something along the lines of, you know, wonder if you consider selling your property, you know, on terms rather than just you know, selling it outright. You know, I'm an investor and I buy properties. Along those lines, and we get pretty good response on that type of call as well. If you've got buyers in place for it, of course, that makes it even easier, because then you can say, I've got somebody who's interested in buying your property specifically. I don't have any properties to sell them, and they want your property. Would you be interested in doing a lease option, or would you be interested in doing it on terms?
Okay.
But are you asking the buyers to ask that question, or are you just asking that question?
You're asking the question. You just ask the buyer to find the property. If they're out there looking for FSBOs, you just ask them to find one they want, and then you go to the FSBO and ask them if they'll do it. Because that's been a very effective way to do it. Because FSBOs, I mean, they do want to do that kind of stuff sometimes. A lot of them won't. I mean, but I think you can get 20-25% that will do it. So if they find four or five properties, you're going to be able to put one of them together. If you're any good.
And one last one, Joe. What's the difference between a lease option and a lease purchase?
It's the same.
Okay.
You know, there's if you're a realtor, it's different. A lease is you have a lease with the option to buy, and then a lease with a lease purchase where you've already agreed to buy within a certain period of time. And usually a lease purchase is a shorter period of time. A lot of times, you know, let's say I find a property that I want to buy, I want to move into it, but I can't. I'm selling my other property out of state, so I can't buy this property because I don't qualify until I get my other property sold, and I should get it sold within 3 or 4 months. So I ask them to do a lease purchase. Let me go ahead, move into the property. I'll make a monthly payment on it, and then as soon as my property sells, I'll be able to qualify for this property and be able to buy it. A lease purchase, you require that person to be able to qualify up front.
Okay.
You know,
right.
And a lease option, they don't qualify. And it's not guaranteed that they're going to buy. They have the option to buy at a specific price.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
But, yeah, so I think most of the time you're going to be doing lease options.
Okay. Thanks.
Who else has a question?
Hey, Joe.
Uh-huh.
This is Mark Fisher in Thorntown, Indiana.
Hey, Mark.
I just have your zero down system.
Okay.
And I'm trying to, I have websites up, and over the weekend got a couple of buyers, but my problem is coming up with sellers. Can you give me some insight on some of the best ways to go about that as far as using the websites?
Well, there's lots of ways to find sellers. You've got the Zero Down book, so there's a lot of different ads in there that you can use on signs. I'd go back to the signs. You can also go into Craigslist. You can go into eBay. I mean, boy, all the FSBO places, all those things you can use if you want to do it online. But it's pretty quick and easy if you just put some signs out. If you put out 25, 30 signs, and here's what the sign should say: I'll make an offer on your house today, and your phone number. None of this cash for home stuff. I'll make an offer on your home today. That's the one that's been working the best for us. And okay. and then when they call in, you got to use the seller profile sheet, and that's in that in those contracts in that book as well.
Yes,
you,
I have that.
Yeah, ask them all those questions, and that'll help you analyze the deal to find out if you can do subject to on it. You know, in that book, I don't talk about multi-mortgages, but that's another possibility where. But I do talk about the land contracts and. And I talk about lease options, so you can do those things as well. Does that answer the question?
Or that'll help. I'm just trying to get off the ground here. So
yeah, I think that would be a good way to get started. I would also look at the for sale by owners, and if you start calling through the for sale by owners, this is grungy work. It's not fun to do cold calls, but you could have a voice blast do it for you. But if you start calling through the for sale by owners and ask them anybody if they'll sell on a lease option or if they'll sell on terms, would they consider that? You're going to get some of them to say yes. You're going to get a percentage that say yes. So that might be a way to do it as well. But you're going to have to make some calls to make that happen. But it doesn't take that long. I mean, to call 100 people, you can do that in 3 or 4 hours. And get a bunch of no's and a bunch of unfriendly people, because FSBOs have a tendency to be unfriendly, and especially if you're an investor. And but you're going to find some that are willing. And the more you do it, the better you're going to get at it. You start finding what's going to work for them. Learning how to talk to these people, learn how to make these offers so that they're attractive is a big part of what I teach in all my courses. And I know I've got some dialogue in that book that might help you a little bit on that process as well, to kind of give you guidelines on what to say and how to say it to these people. But all my other courses, I know in my mentor program, we do this. This is one of my main focuses, and push-button method is that as well. One of the main focuses is learning how to make offers, learning how to make these deals, because the money is in the deal. You got to make the deals to make the money. And everybody, you know, I get questions from people all the time. Well, you know, should I set up my LLC before I get started, or should I, you know, how should I protect my assets? You know, these people have no assets, and you know, they don't need an LLC. They just need to go out there and make an offer and make a deal. And should I set up my website? You know, all those things can be beneficial to you, but the thing that matters the most is that you get on the phone and you make some offers. And you know, then there are ways to automate that. I don't get on the phone and make offers anymore. That's all done automatically for me these days. But you got to learn how to do it before you can be effective automatically. So that's kind of a start for you. Does that help at all?
Yeah, I did a sub two back in February, my first one, before I come across your information, and sort of stumbled through it a little bit. And thanks for your information, because it did open my eyes a little bit more to a few things.
Good.
And I did visit the FSBO sites over the weekend and printed off several places, looked interesting in the areas where these people are interested in buying, and have been making phone calls, so I'll just continue.
Good. Okay, well, keep me posted. I'd like to hear of your success.
Thank you.
All right. Who else has a question?
Joe,
I got a question.
Dana.
I'm sorry, who was that?
Oh, Tina? This is Dana. I have a question.
Dana, okay.
Yes. On selling on a sub 2 and not taking out title policy, does that put a cloud in the title at all?
No.
Okay, so even though you're taking title and it's not insured in any way, it doesn't do anything as far as the title later on.
The title insurance doesn't affect the title itself. It doesn't affect it at all. All it does is reports on title insurance. First of all, what they do is go in and check to see if there's any liens against the property. Mm-hmm. And then if there are liens against the property, they don't insure it, or they insure around those liens. That means they don't cover those liens. If there aren't any liens against the property, then they are willing to insure it. But they don't make any there's no record that there's a title insurance on there. There's no record. There's no public record that there's title insurance or there's not. And it doesn't matter that there's title insurance. What matters is, are there any liens? If there are liens on the property, then you can find that out through a preliminary title report, which is the same way they find out about it, and the same way they determine whether or not they're going to give it title insurance. So if you go to a title company and say, "Will you pull me a title preliminary title report?" They may charge you. I mean, but they won't charge you more than $150. But then you can see for yourself whether there's any liens against it. And if there are, then you don't take title until those things are cured, unless they still make sense in the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Does that?
And so, okay, I guess I'm not quite sure.
Are you coming out?
I think you're not seeing the distinction between...
are you coming?
You're not seeing the distinction between title insurance and what's on your title. I mean, what's being recorded.
Okay. So as long as it's recorded, it's fine. Or if it's not recorded,
let's say you're taking it subject to, that means that the seller is deeding the property to you, correct? You understand
right.
that? Okay. So they're deeding the property to you. All it shows is the property has been transferred. It still shows that there's a loan on there, and that loan still is on there. There's a note on there. The note shows that it's to the other person. That doesn't affect the quality of the title. It affects the lender on some level, whether they if they want it to, but it doesn't affect you. It doesn't affect future buyers. It doesn't affect any of those things.
Okay. All right. Can I ask you another question related to that?
Yes.
When selling on the subject to, does that affect the 1031 exchange at all?
If you're doing subject to, does it affect a 1031 exchange?
Uh-huh.
Well, are you mean if you're buying it or if you're selling it? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Now because the 1031 exchange, if you're selling it on terms, if you're taking a note on the property, taking it back, then technically the sale isn't completed. Only a portion of that sale has been completed. So that's the same way if you do a land contract. But if you're selling it outright, let's say you're giving it the whole thing over subject to, then that can go through a 1031 exchange the same way that anything else. It's just the financing you're talking about. So the way the money makes a difference, the way the money is set up is what makes the difference. You know, you can get an accommodated. Have you got a situation like this that you're doing a 1031?
Actually, we're trying to decide what to do with a property that we have.
Okay.
That we might do a subject to on, but I'm not quite sure if I'm going to have to take capital gains on it.
Do you have equity in it?
Payments over time.
You don't want to sell subject to. That's something you do when you have to.
Okay,
there's a hierarchy of structures, which I've been talking about. Subject to is the top of the hierarchy if you're buying, because it gives you the most control over that property. If you sell it subject to, you just gave that buyer all the control of the property, and you've completely given away your control of the property. So if you have a loan on that property, you're liable for that loan, and somebody else has control of your property. The only reason you sell subject to is if you have to. And you're hoping for the best. The reason you're selling subject to is you want to get rid of that property, and you don't care if it's going to screw up your credit later on. You just want to get rid of it. And so if you're trying to sell a property, trying to pull some equity out of it, you want to sell it on a lease option, because that worry, if that person defaults on their payments, you just evict them in most states. So that's the way to sell the property. So you look at the hierarchy. Subject to is at the top, lease options at the bottom. If you're buying properties, and it's exactly the opposite if you're selling properties. If you're selling properties, lease options now at the top of the hierarchy, because you want to sell on lease option as your preference.
Even though on a sub to, if you get a note and a deed of trust, that still would be the last thing you would do.
You're talking about selling, right?
Right.
When you sell, you give the deed. You don't get a deed. You already have the deed when you're selling.
Right.
So you're gonna give your deed away if you sell it on subject to. That's not something you want to do unless you absolutely have to. There's so many other ways to sell.
Yeah. Well, here in Texas, they usually do a note and a deed of trust so that you could foreclose in case they...
If you sell it on term, okay. So you want to sell your property on terms, right?
Uh-huh.
And the reason you want to sell your property on terms is because
it's difficult to do a lease option here in Texas.
Because they can't do lease options. But well, the lease option is terms. But why do you want to sell it on terms? I mean, why do you want to give let me answer the question. You want to sell it on terms because it creates more buyers, right? And it's more likely you're going to get the most money for the property if you sell it on terms. Is that your reasoning?
Uh-huh.
Okay, good. So if you're selling it on terms and you're in Texas and you can't sell it on a lease option, you want to sell it on a land contract. Because a land contract still keeps you on the deed. When you sell on land contract, there's a separate document that is recorded, and that's the land contract form. And that outlines the agreement between you and the buyer, but you're still on the deed. The only way that they can close that deal when they finally end up purchasing it is for them to, for you to sign over your deed to them. So they, even though they have ownership position, they're not on the deed. So it puts you in a stronger position. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I think that
clarifies. Talk to an attorney down there and tell them what you want to do, that you want to sell it on like a land contract, and they can write you up a land contract. You're gonna have to pay for you should pay and get a good local land contract. Cost you $300. And the attorney will draw it all up. Make sure he emails it to you so you have the document, so in the future if you do it, you'll have a land contract. And you can just use it again.
All right. All right. Thank you.
Good luck with it.
Thanks.
Who else has a question?
Joe, real quick, I'm at work today.
Okay.
I'm a beginning investor based. I actually live in New York City. I have a couple good websites to find both buyers and investors. And I'm curious if you know any good way to find a market based around the metropolitan city beyond sort of trial and error.
Well, you're selling to investors?
I'm not really sure. I haven't really figured out my full game plan yet.
How are you bringing in your investors?
Well, most of what I'm doing is, searching for rent-to-own buyers, and then investors basically just, have a contact form, similar to a website that is just sort of pulling them in.
Are you advertising online, like in Craigslist or something like that?
That's correct.
Okay, so you got Craigslist, you got an ad, or is it directed towards buyers or to sellers, or to investors?
Honestly, most of the work, just from how he's guided in the beginning, was sort of find buyers, get a buyers list going,
mm-hmm.
so that I have some leverage when talking to sellers.
Right.
Investors, I really haven't broken into yet.
Okay.
So I'm just sort of at the beginning, trying to get advice the best way to organize a plan and get started, because I'm sort of stuck in information overload. And
which of my programs do you have?
Yeah. The Zero Down course.
Okay. So maybe the best there's one, the thing that I teach my mentor students, the 6-month mentor students, is the For Rent method.
Okay.
Which is in the Stupid Proof and the Push Button programs.
Okay.
It's not in the Zero Down course. But the Zero Down course is I've had a lot of people had good success starting that, and I think it's maybe actually a little more advanced than the For Rent method. The For Rent method is just a simpler process and a little easier to get started with, and it's one of the things that we've done. And I know I've talked a lot about the For Rent method in the newsletter, and I've talked about building buyers lists and all that stuff in the newsletter over the past few years, and so you should have some of that information as well. But I think that if I were and your average price range in your market?
Do you know New York City at all? I mean,
oh, you're in Manhattan?
Yeah.
We don't? Okay.
Joe, I live in Manhattan, so
right.
Doing a lot of rent-to-own type stuff.
Right.
Probably isn't the best fit there. Surrounding boroughs like Brooklyn, Queens, or even parts of, suburban metropolitan Jersey could be a fit. Just, not sure sort of where to start.
I think that I would test some things around and see where you get your most response.
Okay.
Because you can do a voice blast. Are you familiar with the voice blast technology?
Yeah, I am.
If you do a voice blasts, you can put these names, these phone numbers into the voice blast technology and just blast out your message, the message, hey, would you consider selling your home rent to buy rather than just renting it, to all these landlords in all those areas.
Okay.
And see where you get your responses. And then see if you can match your responses up and start running your Craigslist ads to bring in the buyers there.
Okay.
And of course, if you find buyers or sellers, you're going to want to put signs around those areas. You're not going to be able to put signs in Manhattan.
No.
We've tried. Actually, we've tried. The cops call you really quick.
Okay.
But you can put it in New Jersey, that's for sure. And you can put it in Queens, and you won't have that big of a problem there.
Okay.
So I think that... I think you need to focus on, bringing in sellers. You need to put deals together.
Okay.
And it's great to be able to build a buyer's list, and it does give you credibility. And I actually had an audio that Jim did on at one of our events about, the credibility that having a buyer's list builds for you and really makes you sound like a pro, even though you're just brand new. And it was one of the cash flow audios. And I'll tell you that it's really true. If you have a big list, it does make you sound a lot more credible and makes you feel more confident when you're talking to these sellers. And it makes them feel like you have more credibility. And you have to have credibility with them or they're not going to sign this stuff.
Okay.
And when you sound like an idiot on the phone, they're not going to sign it. Now, you obviously can speak intelligently and you're not going to have that problem. But for the beginning, you kind of stumble over your words and you're going to not sound so great. And it's going to take a little bit of practice until you get good at it. And then when you get good at it, you'll close every deal. I know these guys that are in my group that are good, and I'll get them up in front of the group, and they'll close every single one they talk to on the phone. And it's just not that difficult once you understand how to make it work and how to be credible and how to be empathic and talk to people and try to discover what they really need. Because you can solve their problem, they're going to give you money, or they're going to help you make money.
Well, yeah, that helps me get just a framework to start with.
Yeah, I think if you wanted to get more of my stuff, I'd get the push button method.
Okay.
That's the one that's the most comprehensive. It's got all the internet stuff. If you want to get into that program, and I would even suggest I think the mentor program's the best thing that I do, but and that's a lot of fun as well. But it's also expensive. So okay, does that answer the question?
Absolutely. It's
okay.
It's helpful.
All right. Well, good luck with it.
No problem. You'll hear from me again. Don't worry.
Good. Who else has questions?
Yeah, I got a question.
Okay. Who's this?
Martin.
Who's this?
From Texas.
Okay.
Let's say you get a property and you do the for rent method, and you find a buyer and the buyer paid you the whatever down payment on the either the thing you were talking about, the land contract. What if the seller defaults on his part and they foreclose on him, and the buyer's good on his part?
Yeah, buyer's really screwed if that happens. And there's a potential that they can come back to you and say, hey, why'd you, you know, you were involved in this. I'm going to put you on the lawsuit as well. So there are some things that that you can do. And I think one of the things one of the reasons that Texas set up the lease option laws the way they did was because they had situations where people would default on their loan and selling it on lease option, and the people that were paying the lease option stuff would never be able to buy their property. And this was especially happening with illegal immigrants who were buying properties like this. It was very common, and that this whole law was created around that those incidents, because the people that were illegal immigrants wouldn't go stand up for their rights because they didn't want to get deported. And so these unconscionable investors were really taking advantage of the situation. And I think that the Attorney General stepped in and put a few people in jail and got these laws in place. So it was a knee-jerk reaction because it was they went too far. But I think I kind of went off on a sidetrack. Did I answer the question?
What would happen to, like, for instance, I took the down payment. Would I be involved in it, or?
If you took the down payment, you're involved, yeah. And there is potential of risk. Anytime you're involved in any business transaction, there's always a potential risk that you're going to get sued. You know, and by the way, if you have a house and somebody walks up to your front porch and slips on the ice and breaks his leg, you got potential liability. You know, you get off a bus and you accidentally bump somebody and knock them onto the street and they break their arm, you got potential liability. Anything you do in life, you got potential liability. So don't let that stop you from moving forward.
As long as I guess you pay your down payment back, would be fine.
Not always, but that often solves a problem. You know, if you have the money and you can give them back their money, that might solve the problem. But a lot of times this happens a year or two down the line, so it's a little more difficult to come up with that money after a year or two. So you don't want to do that if you can. What you want to do is stay in communication with everybody and make sure things are going smoothly. You know, touch base with the seller, make sure it's being paid. You can also get the buyer the phone number of the mortgage company and the PIN number so that they can check to make sure that mortgage is being paid every month. And that might be a good way to do it. So if they see that mortgage is suddenly not being paid, then the land contract is in default because the land contracts are set up where they have to make the monthly payments. And they can't refinance it over the amount that's owed by the buyer. So that puts the seller in default and puts the seller at risk, so you can get on the seller and he can stop making the payments directly to the seller. He could make the payments directly to the bank. That would be another way to solve the problem for the buyer. Now, if I was a seller, I want that payments being made to me, as the buyer, as the seller. I don't want the buyer making the payments to the bank, because if he doesn't make the payments, it affects my credit. The seller is the one at most risk, but the buyer does have some risk as well. Does that answer the question?
Yes, and was the ratio and this happening?
I've heard of it happening. It's never happened to me or any of my buyers. I've only heard of it, so I think it's pretty rare.
Just my question. Good.
Okay. All right. Well, good luck with it.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Joe, are you there?
Yes.
Joe, is this conference or this call going to be available to listen to as a download?
Yes, it is, and I'm probably even going to send it to you guys next month.
Okay, so we'll see this one in next month's newsletter?
Either next month or the following. Depends on how long it takes the guy to do the CDs.
Oh, okay.
Because it's already the 17th, so I'm not sure that I'm going to...
Yeah, this has had a lot of good information in it.
Yeah, and you know, I got a website with a member site with all these other calls that we've done. And a lot of those other calls we've done, we've talked about specific deals, which we haven't done as much today. We've done a lot of hypothetical stuff. But you might want to listen to those to see how we structure deals.
Yeah, the one I really want to listen to is not some, well, I guess the hypotheticals are good, but I really want to hear somebody talk to someone, you know, live and in person.
Right.
I'd like to hear. The other thing I want to ask you quickly, about your data files, are they the same for, let's say, the push button as it would be for the cash flow?
No.
Slightly different?
There's no data files for cash flow.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought I got a bunch of files for various kinds of documents.
Not with the newsletter. You might. Did you get stupid proof or push button?
No, actually I got cash flow newsletter only.
Okay.
Well, anyway. All right, that's all I needed.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Yes. Hi. My name is LaJoyce. I'm from Brooklyn.
Hey, LaJoyce.
I'm a newbie.
Okay.
And what I want to find out, as starting out, would it be much easier for me to start to flip properties or deal with pre-foreclosures? What area would be good for a new person just starting out?
Well, flipping properties is the way most people start because you need cash flow.
Okay.
But the way you're going to get rich is by holding properties so you keep them long term.
Okay.
So if you want to be an active real estate investor, flipping properties is the best way to start because, you know, you're gonna work and you're gonna look at it and say, oh God, you know, I've put in a lot of effort and I still haven't done a deal, and eventually you're gonna get to the point though where you do these deals. They don't take very much time overall to do them all, and you make $5,000. It took you 10 hours to do it. You made $500 an hour. I mean, it really gets exciting when you start looking at the numbers. Mm-hmm. What I see happen is people will work at this, and they'll work 3 or 4 months. They'll finally get their first deal done. They'll make $5,000, and they'll say, man, I just worked 3 or 4 months and made $5,000. I can't believe how much work I put into that. But if they look at the amount of time they actually put into the deal, it was about 10 hours. They made $500 an hour for that time.
Mm-hmm.
But the other time was learning curve, the time it took them to learn, and they got discouraged. And then they didn't do any deals after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they think about it, and then they'll come to me like 3 years later and say, you know, I did this deal and it really made sense. I don't know why I didn't keep doing them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it worked. They could do it. It's not a problem. It's not that difficult to make it happen once you understand the process.
Okay.
So you gotta understand the process. You gotta learn the techniques. You gotta learn how to put a deal together, how to structure the deals so that you're gonna make money, and so that you don't close a deal unless it's going to make you money.
Make you money, okay.
And all the stuff that I've been teaching, all these courses, is all about don't close a deal unless it's going to make you money.
Money, right. I just started last week, so I'm just kind of, I'm really a newbie here.
Which one did you get?
The cash flow, the 4 months.
The fast track?
The fast track, I'm sorry, the fast track.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the first, I'm starting out with that, so I didn't really... I'm trying to get my feet wet a little bit, you know.
Okay.
And I heard about pre-foreclosures, so I was wondering, I was a little leery about that, and I'm just, because I'm just starting out, and would that be a good area for me to start into also?
A lot of the deals that you'll end up doing will be pre-foreclosures.
Okay.
But we don't go after pre-foreclosures.
Okay.
And I know that sounds kind of weird, but but the reason is if you go get a list of pre-foreclosures,
okay,
or you go online and you spend $500 and get a website that has pre-foreclosure listings, quote unquote,
mm-hmm,
and you look at those places and you start contacting those people are being contacted by all those other guys that are also paying for that service.
Okay.
They are in shutdown mode. I don't know if you know anybody or if you've ever personally been in a situation where you're going through bankruptcy, you lost all your stuff. Personally, I have. I've been through that. I know that people go into shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
I know that that it's hard. You don't want to return calls. You don't want to talk to people because everybody you talk to is bad news.
Okay.
You know, everybody wants something from it. You got nothing to give.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I've dealt with these types of people all my life. I've been there myself.
Mm-hmm.
So if you call these lists, it's not going to be very effective. What you want to do is have them call you.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The only way to make that happen is through marketing. So you use the marketing techniques that I teach, and there's a ton of them in that Fast Track program.
Yes.
Different ways that you can get them to call you.
Because mm-hmm,
when they call you, now the shoe's on the other foot. Now they're calling and asking for your help rather than you calling and trying to screw them out of their deal.
Oh.
You know, in their perception of it. So now you've got a lot better chance of being able to put a deal together that makes sense for them. Because they have to come to the reality of what's really happening to them.
Mm-hmm.
If they're in a situation that they can't make their payments, they're behind in their payments, you know, whatever the situation is, you can solve the problem with the techniques that we've got.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not going to make any money, you know, and they've got to come to that realization.
which usually doesn't take long to get them there,
okay,
because they know that they're going down.
Time is in.
So if you can save them from foreclosure, you've done an awful lot for them.
Okay. Well, do you have a script, or do we have to follow the script? You know, specific words. I mean, something, you know, really effective that can reach the person.
For it depends on which method you use.
Okay.
What I'm gonna suggest is go through those audios and listen to the different techniques that we use.
Okay.
And decide which one you want to use. You may want to start with the Ferrant method. It's really a simple one to start with.
Okay.
And there are scripts in there that that go with the Ferrant method.
Okay.
So that'll help you get going, and basically, and that's what I do with my at my 2-day events. We get the script out.
Yes, I'm thinking about coming in September. I really am.
Yeah. I mean that, if you come to that, what we actually do that, you're going to hear some people do it in the front, and then we're going to do it, everybody's going to do it, and we're going to spend a couple hours, and everybody gets on the phone and makes calls and tries to put deals together.
Okay.
And it's really interesting how many people actually get yeses from people.
Oh.
That doesn't mean they get a deal,
right,
because they've still got to get a signature and all that stuff, but they get people to say, yes, I'm interested in what you've got to do. And if they were any good, they'd immediately get a deal.
Okay.
But they're not good enough yet all the time to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it happens even though they're not any good.
Okay.
You know, it's amazing sometimes to me. We had an 18-year-old girl who was there with her mom, who put 6 deals together.
Wow.
So
yeah, I read
this. I mean, that kind of stuff happens pretty frequently at these events. And it's a really cool thing to see it happen, especially when you see people there at the event with their eyes just get real big.
Okay.
So, wow, this is possible. This isn't just a bunch of BS that Joe's been throwing out.
Yeah.
It really does work.
It really works. Okay.
And it's proof in the pudding, and that's what's fun.
Yes, because in here in the New York area, it's really, it's mind-boggling, foreclosures and pre-foreclosures, so many things are going on,
Right. Well, that means there's an awful lot of people that can use your help.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things that I believe is very important to having a good business and having a good life personally is that you find something that you can do that you enjoy doing,
mm-hmm,
and that helps other people, solves other people's
problems,
and makes you a lot of money.
Right.
and this does all those things for me. Not everybody likes to do real estate.
Yes,
but I'm presuming that you have an attraction to it, or you wouldn't be here.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
I'm learning.
Yeah, and that's what it takes. Once you learn this stuff, don't just learn it. You got to put it into action.
Put it into action, okay.
Because I'll tell you, this is the biggest problem, mm-hmm, that I see with all my students across the board. Mm-hmm. They don't take action on the stuff that I teach them.
Okay.
Or they take action on things that don't make any difference, that won't make them any money.
Okay.
The thing that makes your money is putting deals together. So focus your energy, focus your time on putting deals together, and you'll be a lot more likely to succeed.
Okay. All right.
Well,
thank you so much.
Good luck to you.
All right.
Who else?
Want to go now?
Any other questions?
Yeah, I do. Just staying again, I have another question.
Okay.
This one's kind of like more of a tactical sort of question. I'm thinking about buying outside of my state, and I was just wondering how you go about putting up signs if you're not there to do it.
Well, how do you want to buy outside your state? You want to buy and sell? You want to flip properties out there, or you want to buy to keep for the long term?
Buy and keep so that I could rent them.
Okay, so you're going to find a property, and then you're going to rent them out, and you're going to do it out of state, and how are you going to buy them? You're going to buy them subject to? You're going to put a new mortgage on them? How are you going to do that?
Subject to.
So you want to find subject to deals, keep them out of state. My suggestion, and this is what I do personally, I have somebody else manage the property. Don't do it yourself.
Property management company?
Yeah. You can do it yourself, but a property management company will save you a lot of time and effort. And if you want to do lease options and you want to do that, it's not that difficult to do it out of state. And we've actually done it, actually quite a bit. But I kind of switched over to just using property managers because it's a little easier to do. But if you want to do it out of state, here's how you do it. Get a lockbox. You got a property. It's vacant. Get a lockbox on the door. Get the phone numbers of your neighbors on both sides so that if there's any problems, and make sure they have your phone number. So if there's any problems or whatever, and they see the house burning down or whatever, they can call you. Somebody's broken in, they can call you. Grass is getting too high, they can call you. You know, they make sure they can understand it's okay to complain. I don't want those kind of calls. So that's why I have a property manager. But you can do this from out of state by doing it this way. You can also have whoever you're buying it from put the sign in the yard for you. We've bought properties from people that were outside of our state, and the owners were not in the state where that house was. So what we ended up doing is we'd get a hold of the phone number of the person next door. We'd call them. We'd send them a sign in a lockbox to put in the yard, and they'd do it for us. And people are very nice and very accommodating, especially neighbors. And they put a lockbox on there. And then when you get phone calls on it, and of course you want to get more signs up, you want to do more advertising, you can either hire somebody to put more signs for you up around the area because that's the best form of advertising, or you can put ads in the paper. You know, you can put ads in Craigslist to sell the properties. You know, it's not that difficult to do. And when people call you and want to see the property, you ask them to drive by the property, and when they get in front of the house, to give you a call, and you'll give them the lockbox information. Then they call you up on your cell phone. When they get there, you give them the lockbox combination. We've never had a house trashed like this. It's got to happen eventually. It's never happened to me so far. I don't think it's going to happen, to be honest with you, but just, you know, if it happens to you, you know, don't come back to me. But if they trash the, I mean, the likelihood is they go in the property and you tell them, when you give them the key box, say, call me as soon as you get done. I want to make sure you get the door locked up. Will you please call me? Make sure you have their cell phone number as well so that you can call them 10 minutes later. And if they don't call you. So you call them up or they call you. You say, yeah, we got it locked up. And then your question is, well, what did you think of the property? And you try to sell them the property and get their comments on it. A lot of times we've never even been in these properties, so the only way we find out what the condition of the properties or if there's problems with the properties is from the people that are looking at the properties to buy. We've been in situations like that. And if you want to make sure that you have a lease option tenant in there and you want to make sure it's a good property before you even buy it, make your subject to offer contingent upon having a tenant. So you don't close it until your tenant's in place. That way, if there are problems with the property that the seller wasn't telling you about or didn't know about, then you know you're going to find out about it through the buyer, and then you can either renegotiate or you can not do the deal. But if you don't find a buyer for it, you'll never have that risk of having to make that mortgage payment. If you know an area, and once you get experienced at this and you know the areas you're working in, you're going to just go ahead and take those properties subject to, so you have them vacant, so you've got them, you know, ready to go, and they're your properties. You don't have to worry about going to the seller later. But until you know that stuff, you may want to not take the deal, not close the deal with the seller until you have your buyer in place. It's just part of the safety net method that I've designed.
And Joe, is that something that you would recommend that, you know, because I'm fairly new at this, probably only about a year actively doing it. Do you recommend that we wait on that till we're more seasoned at it, investing out of state? I mean.
Well, I think, what's your average price range where you're at?
About 150.
I'd stay where. What state are you in?
Texas.
Yeah, I'd stay in Texas. I'd stay there. Do it where you're located. If you were in California, if you were in L.A., I'd say then go ahead and do it someplace else. Add that to the mix. Because California is done the same way. If you have a $600,000 house or $1 million house, all the stuff that I'm teaching is exactly the same. But the intimidation level of a new investor is so much higher, and you're dealing with a different kind of seller, a person who's a little more sophisticated. You know, somebody who's got $1 million house versus a $150,000 house is going to be a little more sophisticated, so you're going to have to be a little bit more on the ball to make it happen. I don't see any difference personally between doing it in California and doing it in Texas, you know, but I think that a new person would. So if I were you, I'd stay in Texas right now and work on those deals there.
Okay.
Unless you want just the lease option thing that's bugging you and you want to do it someplace different. You know, then
I just found that there's so many rules here compared to, you know,
right,
other states.
Right.
And also with the market being, not very good throughout the U.S.
Well, if you put, you know, it's not that, and once you learn how to do subject to deals, you know, we were cranking those things out for a while and selling them to investors, and I may start doing that again. I've actually been talking to my mentor students about it because I partner with them on a lot of different things, and one of the things that I may start doing with them, I'm working on it right now, is to have them put together subject to deals, you know, where they'll put together three or four at a time, and then we'll sell them as packages to investors. And you know, if you're in my mentor program, I'd do that kind of thing with you. But you could also do the same kind of thing where you put together these types of things and just sold them to other investors. And just all they have to do is they just have to pay you $3,000 or $4,000 or $2,000 or whatever and take the property. And all you have to do is struck and put it together. So you don't have to do anything. You don't have to be there. You can do it all over the phone. It's really not difficult to do this stuff. You just have to. You just have to know how to put the leads together.
Yeah. With that last thing you said, as far as taking assignments, do you usually just get out of the transaction altogether once you have your assignment key, or do you see it through too?
Yeah, try to assign a purchase agreement rather than a deed. You know, instead of, if you're doing it subject to, rather than taking the deed yourself and then deeding it to somebody else, get a purchase agreement with the subject to and assign the purchase agreement and let them go the deed direct, have the deed go directly from the seller to the buyer.
So then with that, you just take your fee and you don't have to.
You take your fee, yeah. All you're getting is an assignment fee for that purchase agreement. You're out of the deal. And you're never on the deed. You know, it's a really sweet way to do this.
Thank you.
You bet. Good luck with it. Who else has questions? I guess we're past our hour and a half, but anybody else?
Yeah.
Okay, who's that?
Yeah, this is Peter Nguyen. I've just joined in a bit late. I'm in California, and I thought you have at noon.
Ah, okay. So what can I do for you? What's the question?
Good question. As I the lease option tenant that you asked us to buy.
Okay.
How do we do that?
How do you find lease option tenants?
Yeah.
Which of my programs do you have?
The cash flow.
Okay. So the newsletter, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I talk about different ways almost every month to find buyers, but I think one of the most effective ways to find lease option buyers, the biggest bang for your buck, the cheapest cost per lead, is the bandit signs. And I'll do it real quick with you, but you can go back and listen to this audio a little bit earlier on. I talked about this in a little more detail. But if you just get a sign that says rent to buy, no qualifying, and a phone number, you write it on cardboard and stick it around, put it out 30 of them around an area, you're going to get calls, and you want to build that list. It's really important to build the list and get everybody's contact information so you can keep selling them properties, you know, other properties. The first one you have may not be what they're looking for, but they may buy the second one or the third one or the fifth one, or a year from now they may buy from you. And that happens pretty frequently. So use signs. That's one of the best ways to find buyers. We also use Craigslist. We've used eBay. We've used RentClicks. We've used ForSaleByOwner.com. I mean, there's lots of ways to find buyers.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Anybody else got anything?
Hey, Joe, I got one more question before you get out of here.
Is that John?
Okay. I have been working with a couple of different people, and say, for instance, this person, which is the seller, they're saying, I want to sell this house for $100,000. And, of course, you know, since I'm doing it on a subject to pretty much or so forth, I'll go to them and I'll try to raise my price like 10% more of the asking price or so forth. But what I don't understand, when they go to get that loan, or when I go to get that, or when a person that I'm moving into the house that's renting to own goes to get that loan, the loan officer is only going to loan so much on the house, even though there's more money stacked up inside of it. You know what I'm saying?
Correct. So you want to know what to do about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, you probably aren't going to be able to sell it for 10% more. Well, 10%. Well, actually, that's not true. On the lower price properties, the $100,000, 10% above is doable. The values of the area is probably going to go up as well. Now, the worst thing that can happen on a lease option
if you know, they come, they say, yes, I want to exercise the option. I'm buying it for $110,000. The market value when I bought it a year ago was $100,000. Now it's gone up in the value. I mean, if we stretch the value on the appraisal, you know, and appraisals have some flexibility in them. You know, they've got 7% within appraisals is allowable. You know, they try to get close on, but there's leeway within appraisals. So so there's 7% is quite a bit of money. There's quite a bit of spread there. So if the property only went up a couple percent, there's still a likelihood that they could get it appraised for 110 a year later. It's more likely that the option won't even be exercised. Only 30% of options actually get exercised.
Right.
The other opportunity is that you could lower your price. You could take less money. If it only appraised for 108, then you'd sell it for 108 and make $2,000 less. Or you could make the seller or the buyer come up with an extra $2,000 on top of the loan. That's hard to do sometimes. That's hard to do. So, but you can try it. So they got lots of different options, or you can just choose not to sell it and then go out and find another lease option buyer to buy it again later. So it depends on what you want your cash flow to be. Most of your cash flow is going to be coming in from flipping your properties, and then look at the money that you're making on the back end of your lease options as gravy money, that's long-term money. So you got short-term money and long-term money. Lease option payoffs is long-term money. And it may not come out in 1 year or 2 years or 3 years. It may take a little longer.
Okay.
Then again, it might, and you can still structure it as though it will, you know. But really, it doesn't hurt you if it doesn't. It just means you don't get the capital right away. You still got the equity.
Right.
You still have the money. It's still yours. It's just going to take longer to get it.
Okay. Cool.
All right. Well, good luck with it.
Thanks. Joe, I have another question.
Okay.
Yeah, you say somewhere that the conversion within the lease option tenant into the actual buyers is about 30%, is that what you say?
They have people that actually take out a lease option, about 30% will exercise the option. And it's going to be higher, you're going to have a higher percentage if they put more money down. So if you had somebody who's putting, you said you're in California, so if you had somebody who's putting $5,000 down versus somebody who's putting $10,000 down as a lease option fee, as
right.
non-refundable money, the person who puts $10,000 down is going to be more likely to exercise their option than the $5,000 person.
I see. And the percentage of that on the price of the property, usually how much do you have?
Of the lease option?
Yeah.
Well, the way you determine how much lease option fee you get is you have a call from your buyer, and you ask them, how much have you got for a down payment? And I think I said this earlier in the call. If they say, I got $5,000, you say, well, if you had seven, I know we could make this work. If they say they got $10,000, well, if you had $13,000, I know we could make this work. If they say $50,000, well, if you had $60,000, I know we could make this work. So whatever it is they've got, you try to get more. And then you can always negotiate down from there. So the lease option is determined by what you negotiate, not by any percentage of the property. Does that make sense?
So you said depends on the buyer.
You base it on how much the buyer has, not by how much the property is worth.
But don't you have a standard way? Usually people like say a house like 200,000. You know.
I know a minimum that I'd want to get. You know, and you can determine what that is, whether it's 5,000 or 2,000. Different markets are going to be different. The higher end market's going to get you a higher lease option fee, in general. But you know, if you can make 5,000, you know, if your standard was 10,000, and suddenly a deal came along, and you only make 5,000. Does that mean you throw that deal away because you don't want to only take 5,000? No, you take the $5,000, you know, and you move on. So you determine. You're always the one determining how much you're going to take. And you're going to do it based on how much the buyer has, not by how much you're selling it for. Now, you may—I know guys that do $2,000 lease option fees. They're selling $100,000 houses, so they'll do $2,000 lease option fees all the time, and they do a bunch of them. And they'd rather do 10 of them, you know, at $2,000 than do two of them at $5,000.
So that's their philosophy. They just keep the things rolling through because by doing more deals, it generates other business. It brings in other sellers. It brings in other buyers. It brings in a lot of things because you got more signs out there. You got more stuff happening around you. So they're all the snowball activity. So it makes sense to do more deals, even if you make a little less money for it. So, but ultimately, you have to determine how much. What's the least that it's worth it for you to do these deals? What's the least? What's the most you can spend on your advertising? Those are things that you're going to learn as you do more of them, because you know, if it costs you $200 in signs to make $2,000, that's 10% is your advertising cost. So, if it costs you $1,000 in signs to make you know, $1,500, now is it worth it? And it might be, but you got to decide for yourself. Sometimes it's worth it if it's your first deal, just to get it done, just so you have the experience of getting it done and learning how to do it. You know, I've got people that have closed deals they've only made $500 on, but they're happy about it because they got their first deal done, and the second deal they made $2,000, the third deal they made $5,000, and you know, on and on. So hopefully that answers the question. Anybody else? Any final questions before we wrap it up today?
Yeah, Joe, this is Dana.
Okay.
On the lease option fee, do you usually credit that as a true down payment will reduce their future purchase price on the house?
Yeah, I apply it towards the purchase price of the house. So if they're paying $150,000 for the house and they put $5,000 lease option, they now owe $145,000. If they document the lease option payment to me properly, and to do that, they just need to talk to their mortgage broker to show that the money came from their account, you know, came through a cashier's check. Make sure you have a mortgage broker that they talk to show that it's going to be documented properly. Then many banks will allow that down payment to apply towards the purchase of their property and will allow them that as their down payment. There's also FHA loans that allow some of their monthly payments to go towards it, even if you didn't allow it in your contract to them. So they can apply some of that. And basically, if you want to do that, you could raise the price by, you know, if they'll allow $3,000 of the payments to go towards the down payment, which FHA will sometimes if it's paid with a check, you could just raise the price by $3,000 and then give them that $3,000 back. So as long as it appraises. Yeah, so there's a lot of cool things you can do. The more, you know, obviously the more you do this stuff, the more little tips you'll get and hints you'll get on how to make it work better and better.
Okay.
All righty.
So thank you so much.
You bet.
Bye.
Anybody else? I'll take one more question, if there are any.
Well, I have a question if nobody else.
Okay.
This one is a little off the topic, but it's real estate anyway. When a bank forecloses and there's a lot of equity on the house, what I've read in some literature is that the bank has to give the owner that difference, the equity, and they just keep the balance, correct?
Correct.
So
but their balance includes all the late payments, the fees, the attorney costs. There's very rarely any money left for that homeowner. Very rare. Okay.
But if there is, for some reason, it defaulted, is that the case they usually return the balance of the equity back to the owner?
It's what they sell it for. So let's say the bank takes the property back, and the property is worth, let's say, $150,000, and they're owed $100,000 on it. They want to sell that property as quickly as they can to get it off their books and off of their negative. So if they would be whole by selling it for $100,000, why would they sell it for $101,000 if they had to give that $1,000 back to the owner?
Right.
There's no reason for them.
Yeah, because in purchasing foreclosures, sometimes they're real sticklers about saying on that, you know, they have to have a certain amount, and I wasn't sure if they were just trying to get the market value for it, or if there was that much owed on the property to begin with that they're staying at that number.
An REO, real estate owned by a bank, they're determining their price the same way that we were talking about short sales earlier, where they go in, they have a broker's opinion done, they figure out what the value is of the property, they figure out what the as-is sale price would be right now, how much it's going to cost them for their brokerage, all that stuff, and they determine their what the most likely amount of money that they can get for it, best and worst case scenario, and then they put it in the market. And if they're motivated, they drop the price. If they're not motivated, they keep it up a little bit higher. And their motivation is usually determined by how much of an inventory they have of REOs. The more REOs they have, the more motivated they typically get, because they're not able to, you know, they're going to screw up their credit if they continue to have all this inventory. So, you know, you're better off in a market that's got a lot of REOs. You're going to get better prices. But but remember, when you're dealing with REOs, you're going to pay those guys cash. You're not doing subject twos with those guys. Or new loan or cash or whatever.
Okay.
Alrighty.
Alrighty,
well,
you bet.
Was there somebody who had a question there that was just speaking up?
No, I just want to ask... Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes. Did you have a question?
Is this German Mass again?
What's that?
Yes, I was wondering, for your new website that you released July 2nd, is there someone that you'd have a preference to have a use the websites?
The new websites that I released July 2nd? I don't think I released any.
Yeah, the new page that you have for a driver?
You must be thinking of somebody else. That's not me. That's not me.
No?
Yeah, that's not my stuff. I've not heard of that.
Was it June then?
I haven't released any new websites lately.
Or an ad page of some sort?
I sell properties. You know, that's something different we do.
Yeah, it was a selling page.
Where we're selling properties, my own properties, the pre-construction stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, is there someone that you can refer me to build a website?
Oh, I've been building my own.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I build my own.
All right, thank you.
You bet. All right, there was one more lady with a question.
No, I just wanted to ask a quick question. When you're dealing with... foreclosure, pre-foreclosure, if you have a second mortgage, could you pick up the second mortgage on the property instead of the first mortgage? Would that be possible?
If it's a pre-foreclosure and you just want to take over at subject two, okay. you also have to make the second mortgage whole as well as the first. If you just take a first, mm-hmm. the second can foreclose. So you're taking it over subject to the existing loans.
Okay, I see.
So, or liens, or encumbrances, or anything else that's on the property.
Okay.
There's mechanic liens on the property. Those are there before you get the deed. Then they're your problem.
Oh, okay.
So you got that. I mean, that's one of the reasons you do a preliminary title report, to see what other liens are against the property.
Right. Okay. That's good. Oh, that's what I wanted to find out.
But just remember, you know, if you screw this up, you know, and you took this property subject to. The worst thing that happens is you go back to the seller and say, look, you know, I screwed up. I shouldn't have taken this property. I can't make the payments on it. I'll be happy to deed it back to you, but it's going to go into foreclosure if I keep it.
Okay.
And it's going to hurt their credit, not yours.
Okay.
And you apologize and you try to move on.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So,
all right. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the session here today.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, everybody. Well, I'm going to wrap it up for today. And, boy, we put in about 2 hours today, so hopefully you got some good stuff from this. I'm going to put this on a disc, hopefully, for everybody. So we'll be mailing these out either next one or the following one. I'm not sure which. And then we'll also have stuff on the website for you to look as well. All right. Thanks a lot, and good luck with your investing.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.